I think people forget you really can do anything with software. Being a software engineer is genuinely a superpower, in my opinion. And it's, you know, there's a lot of focus on getting jobs and stuff like that is the goal for a lot of people. But also take a look around you and see what sort of optimizations and improvements you can make to your own life with this new power that you have. Because for me, it's been a game changer.
Welcome to the show. Tell us a quick little bit about yourself.
Thanks for having me. I'm currently an engineering manager at Cloudflare. I've been working there for about 4 years. I'm incredibly interested and somewhat involved in Go and the Go community as well. In my spare time, I like to pretend I'm a musician, but I'm not really. Like I muddle around with various instruments. It's something I'd like to get more into, to be honest, this year. So maybe I know people usually set New Year's resolutions in January, but maybe I can set one now. More chance of success, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's the best time. Cloudflare is an interesting company. What excited you about Cloudflare? How did you end up there?
Yeah, it's really funny because I do a lot of interviews for engineers potentially joining us, and we all have the same story. Like most folks hear about Cloudflare and want to join it because of the blog. Cloudflare's blog is amazing, and I think it's the best marketing tool I think I've ever seen. I'm not sure it's necessarily the intention of it. It generally is just part of the culture to be transparent and share interesting things. But the Cloudflare blog is famous with engineers. And so pretty much everyone joins like, oh, I read this on the blog and it made me interested in the company. So I was looking around and you had some roles open and I applied. And my story is no different, unfortunately. That's how I kind of came across Cloudflare too. I heard someone describe it as the biggest company most people have never heard of. And I quite like that description. Because if you talk to any engineers, they know exactly what it is. But, you know, if I'm at a wedding or something and someone's like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I work at Cloudflare. And I just see people's like eyes glaze over. I'm like, oh, okay. Moving on.
Coming back to the blog. Yeah, I have to admit, I've shared several of those blog posts. I even, about 12 months ago when I was looking for a new role, I've submitted my CV once as well from that blog.
Oh, excellent. Oh. It's one of the hardest problems I'm facing at the moment is just honestly it's overwhelming how many applicants we're getting at the moment, and it's really hard to ensure that we make sure we speak to everyone who's a great fit. And the challenge is there's tons of people who probably be a great fit at the moment. I think the hiring market is in a really tough place, where there's a lot of really really talented folks looking for new roles at the moment. There's been a lot of layoffs. There's new people entering the workforce every year. And it's those people at the start of their careers I feel the most sorry for, because I think it's incredibly difficult to land your first role at the moment. One thing that I am proud of is Cloudflare has a pretty cool internship program, and we do hire interns every year. Last year we had an amazing intern, and she's actually just joined us full time as well. So I think they're the opportunities to look out for, but even those, they're super competitive.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you know, you hit the nail on the head there. The reason I saw Cloudflare and the reason I was looking was obviously the blog and a lot of talk about lists as I was learning it. And I was looking because I'd been made redundant. You know, it's the way the market is at the moment. And it's, as you say, it's very tough. It's the toughest I've seen the market in my entire career.
Yeah.
Even going back to sort of 2000, 2001, when we had the dot-com crash and then the telco crash just after. It's much worse now. And even, again, 2008, when we had the financial crash, it wasn't this bad.
Yeah.
So great to hear you have that internship. There's a lot of comments on internships, which I don't know if they were a thing when I was at that level. So I'm never really sure where it is, but a lot of comments back and forth from people of unpaid internships and they should be paid, should they not? What does Cloudflare do?
Cloudflare pays for internships. They're paid pretty well, I think, actually, as internships go. And our internship production code. Like we give them projects, we pair them with engineers and they ship something meaningful. It's one of the requirements of the internship. So we have like an internship lead internally and they'll reach out to hiring managers who are interested in having an intern. And you kind of have to interview to get an intern. You have to prove that you're going to give them a good project and that you're going to give them a good experience at Cloudflare. Like we ultimately want our internship program to convert folks from interns into full-time hires. So it's seen as, we take it pretty seriously and it's seen as a big deal. One thing we experimented with this time for the second time, last year we did a fully remote internship. I think it went okay, but I do feel there's value in having some in-person time with folks at that point in your career. I think you can just do things a lot quicker and sort of build rapport and ask questions that maybe you don't feel as comfortable asking on chat software or whatever. So this time we did something a little bit different, and we did kind of insist that you spend a couple of days in the office, and we made sure folks were available a couple of days a week in the office. And I think that was the right way to go. And so I think that's something we'll be looking to do more and more in internships, is at least at that early stage in your career, just having it a little bit more hybrid. Even though Cloudflare is a fully remote as a company now, we do have offices everywhere, and we're encouraged to use them where it makes sense. And I think that's one of the places where it made sense. I like to think our intern was more successful because of the time she got to spend with her peers this time. So that's not a company thing. It's just like in our team, I think that worked really well. And so I'll be looking to do that again this summer.
Cool. So you mentioned that they, you know, they ship real code and they get stuck in. So how long are they with you? How long's that ramp up time? How quickly do they get to that point?
Yeah, we're pretty flexible in terms of how long the internship is, but typically it's 3 months over the summer. Ramp up time depends on the project and the individual, but we've seen people start shipping code in a couple of weeks, which is amazing, because one thing we've always tried to do at Cloudflare is keep our onboarding pretty lean. So we take onboarding classes. So people onboard together with people from outside the department. It's not just engineers who onboard. You onboard with other people in different departments. You all go through some training around like how Cloudflare makes money and how we position ourselves. And then we do like what we call Dev Bootcamp, where we teach you all the developer tools you'll need to get up and running. So when you drop into your team after sort of 1 to 2 weeks of doing the onboarding, you're in a place where you can start thinking about contributing it somewhat, because you kind of have your environment set up, hopefully, and access to the tools you need and roughly understand how we ship. So we kind of set that baseline, which is really helpful. And then in our team specifically, I credit a lot of our ability to get folks shipping fairly quickly with Go. It's one of the reasons I love Go as a language, is if you've learned any other language, you'll be able to pick up Go fairly easily. That's not to say you're going to be writing perfect Go, but it's enough to, you know, kind of understand what's going on and then make some contributions to code bases that potentially already exist.
Cool. I'll come back to Go in a minute, because that's definitely something I'm keen to talk more about. So that's really interesting, because I've written a few posts recently about onboarding and how they were triggered from my own recent very bad experience. And a number of people commenting that it takes at least 6 months for a developer to join a new team and start adding value. That doesn't align with my experience. It doesn't align with my expectations. I think if it's taking 6 months to get somebody adding value to a team, you're doing it wrong. You're failing as a manager. You're failing as a company when you onboard people. What are your thoughts on that?
I can agree with more of what you just said. I think I love when new folks join us, and I often find they add value in the first meeting we have. And that value might be, hey, this process doesn't work, or that doesn't make sense, or this documentation is out of date. That's value. I think when people are saying, you know, you're not adding value for 6 months, I think your expectations are way too high, and you're probably expecting them to be able to lead an entire feature or something like that. But that's not where value comes from. If you're trying to build a team that's made up of like different skill sets and different backgrounds, value can be found in updating documentation. It can be found in you know, joining communities within your company. It can be joining those and helping. It can be asking really good questions. Like, why do we do it this way? Like, in my old company, we did this. Like, why don't we do that here? We talk about sometimes like burden of knowledge. And I think sometimes if you've been somewhere too long, you can have a burden of knowledge, and it can be really helpful to have someone with fresh eyes come in and just challenge the status quo a little bit. And so I often see people adding value in the first day or two, based on just the good questions they're asking, just leading to us challenging our assumptions.
Yeah, I think you're right on that burden of knowledge. We can get a bit tunnel focused. We're so busy doing the work, we don't look up and think about the bigger picture. I think the counter argument that a lot of people make is that your net benefit to the team is negative for the first 6 months. And I still don't agree with that. How about you?
Yeah, I just struggle with that point of view, honestly. I'm trying in my head when I was paused for a second, and I'm just running through the different ways you might say it's net negative. But I can't get there, because if you're saying it slows down delivery, like, that's true, but that's also okay, because there's a lot more to growing a career than delivering software, right? There's, especially for folks who are maybe looking for the level up or looking to be promoted, or maybe they want to explore being a manager, having new people join is a great opportunity for them to be a mentor, which is like a great first step to move towards being more senior or being a manager, helping them overcome hurdles, like answering those, like, why do we do it this way sort of questions. Like, that's really helpful. And that's immediately a net positive because those folks are looking for growth opportunities. So if you don't give them them, they're going to look elsewhere. And they're usually the people who you want to keep around. So yeah, I just really struggle with the net negative thing. If your goal specifically is just to deliver software and nothing else matters apart from like the amount of Jira points you deliver or whatever, then fine. Like maybe you can reach that conclusion, but I struggle to get there personally.
I totally agree. And I'd absolutely agree that you want those growth opportunities. People that need to progress or want to progress their career, they need that chance to have somebody new to come on board or somebody junior or somebody that they can coach and mentor in some way. And that can't just be a bunch of peers that are all at the same level. You need either somebody that's new to the organization and has got some learning, or a junior or somebody less senior than them for that growth. Which I think creates a lot of problems for this idea of senior-only teams. Have you experienced a senior-only team? What was your impression of that?
Yeah, so I've never sort of landed in a senior-only team, but I always thought Netflix model was interesting because they always claim to only hire seniors, right? But they also, by like all accounts of people I spoke to, have got a pretty good engineering culture as well. I don't know if that's so as true these days where the market's a little bit harder. I think in the zero interest rate environment, it's been quite easy to maybe mask some cultural problems. And I'm not saying that's what Netflix did. I just mean generally you could kind of throw money at problems and do things that maybe didn't make financial sense, or maybe didn't scale because there was fundraising available. But I do wonder if in the new world where money costs money, there'll be some of those senior only teams may struggle to hire great people, retain great people, may start to think about things differently. The reason I mentioned Netflix specifically is because I did read recently they've stopped hiring only seniors now. And I was wondering if that's part of the reason why.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know. I have no insights on that other than, as you say, with new laws in California and several parts of the US, they have to be listing salaries now, and they list such a broad range of salaries. I assume from that they are now recruiting at a more junior level.
Yeah.
Cool. So the other thing we talked on a little bit is remote work. I've been a fairly outspoken advocate of remote work, but over the last 6 months, I've started to think it doesn't work if you don't have the right team. And I've started to think that definitely things like onboarding are quite useful to do in person. And maybe if somebody doesn't have that network and they need that network for their role because they're a junior or their role depends heavily on a network, that maybe an initial few weeks or months in the office or some sort of hybrid might be a good idea. So again, what are you thinking about for your team and for interns or even more senior hires in the future?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm the same as you. I've gone backwards and forwards on remote work quite a bit. So before 2020, I'd never worked remotely really. I'd done the odd day here and there like we all had, but it was by exception. You had to ask your manager like weeks in advance. Like it was quite difficult to work remotely. When I left my last role and joined Cloudflare, I went straight away from working full-time in the office to working remotely. And it took me a while to get used to it. You know, it's very quiet at home. You miss the water cooler conversations. But then I kind of reached a different point in the curve where I'm like, this is amazing. Like I have no commute. Like I live near London, so commuting an hour and a half into an office wasn't an unusual thing. And getting sort of 3 hours of my day back, I'm like, well, look at all these extra things I can do. And I've used them well, in my opinion. Like I've wrote books and I've done courses and I get to be more involved in the Go community and I get to do all these growth things around my job because that just happens to be what interests me. But I got this time to do the stuff that I wouldn't have been able to do before. So I love it from that perspective. But now also I do have days where I just like miss having a team around me and being able to just go to the office and collaborate closely and like celebrate wins together and whiteboard. Like get on a whiteboard and draw some squares and circles. Like I miss doing that stuff. So I definitely appreciate for new folks entering the workforce. Like I feel privileged that I got to have both experience and form an opinion. But for some folks just coming out of college now, like they actually don't get to experience the other way. So they don't actually necessarily get an opportunity to decide what they prefer. Because there are companies that do hybrid working. There are companies that do fully remote. But I'm not aware of that many companies doing fully in person for tech. I'm sure they are out there, but it probably seems like a risk to take a role like that, especially for your first job, because it seems like quite a big commitment versus remote working, which seems to make sense. And, you know, there's people coming out of university now and they basically did their whole degree remotely, you know, So some people even have anxiety around going to a big office and spending a bunch of time with people. So I think we've got a lot of work to do to recover from that. And I do think in-person events and encouraging folks to spend time networking with their peers is a valuable thing to do. Whether that has to be to do work or you just make budgets available for folks to be able to get coffee or drinks or dinner with their team, I'm not really sure yet. I'm still figuring this out. I do think I mentioned previously about the intern kind of spending time in person. I think that was valuable. And I think as new hires join our team, depending on the seniority, varying levels of insist to suggest we spend more time in the office together to kind of get them up to speed, just so I can introduce them to people and make sure that they have a network. And I guess that's, you know, you mentioned, how do I think about that? I think that's my job, is to make sure they build that network. So I make sure I let them connect to the people that I've figured out how to connect with, because it will help them find friends and their groups and their peers and people to work with. So I think that's the most important thing I can do for anyone joining, whether it's remotely or in person, is just making sure they have the tools they need to build that network.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a key part of being any kind of senior for somebody as they onboard, particularly as a manager. I wanted to go a little bit back, talk a little bit more about how you got into software engineering. So how did you come to software engineering? How did you end up where you are now?
Yeah, so I took the pretty classic route, I think. I was the nerd in school who spent all my time playing video games and tinkering with a computer. When I got towards sixth form, which is, I don't know, what's the US equivalent of sixth form? Just in case you've got US listeners, I actually don't know.
I don't just know finished, myself.
Finishing high school, just as I was finishing high school, I guess, and thinking about which university or college to go to. My school didn't really advertise computer science as an option. And being completely transparent, when I signed up to do it, I'm not entirely sure I knew exactly what I was signing up for. I just knew I liked computers and that was a computer thing. So that's what everyone recommended I do. So I should go and do that. Thankfully, I loved it. So I did a computer science degree at the University of Birmingham. I focused on AI, which is very relevant these days, but I haven't done much with that side of my degree, unfortunately, personally. But one thing I did, which is probably one of the best decisions I ever made, and I think if folks are in university and are open to it, I think this is still a thing and you should definitely leverage it, is you can do these things called like placement years or sandwich years. And basically between second and third year, you take a year out, you work for a company, you get paid. And a lot of times, and in my case, it leads to a job offer for after university. And that was probably the best thing I did, because whilst everyone else was stressing about final exams and the dissertation and they had to look for a job, I didn't have to look for a job. I just had to focus on my studies, make sure I did well. And I had a job offer waiting for me once I finished. So I did that placement year with General Electric. I was based in Manchester for that. And then once I graduated, I went on to this scheme they have. It's called at the time it was called the IT Leadership Program. I think they've rebranded it now as like Software Development Leadership Program or something like that, just to sort of recognize that it's more focused on software now. But that was a really cool scheme. I was very lucky to get to do it. I basically spent 6 months doing four different jobs in the business. So I do one for 6 months, then I'd move to a different one, and I'd do another 6 months. And as part of that, I got to spend some time in London. I got to spend a bunch of time in the US. I got to see GE Capital, which doesn't exist anymore, but was a bank. And I got to see GE Aviation, which is one of their most famous and more traditional business units. And I was a software engineer in both those places for 2 years. Once I had done that, you start to look for roles after the program, they call it. So you've got to kind of roll off the program into a real job, if you will. And it was at that point I was kind of interested in exploring startups. Like, I'd been part of this big machine. And I was like, I want to go and, you know, I was definitely in the camp of glorifying startups, I think. They seemed like the coolest thing in the world to me. So I really wanted to go and work in one. So I spent some time looking for the smallest company that would have me. And I went to work for a company called Crowdcube. So I think GE is tens, if not hundreds of thousands of employees. And I joined Crowdcube, and I think there were about 30 in total. So Crowdcube's an equity, yeah, quite a contrast. So Crowdcube is like an equity fundraising platform. It's still around today, so it's a really cool company. The way I like to think of it is, you know, in Dragon's Den, where you can pitch a product and then the dragons give you money. Crowdcube, like, you put up a pitch, like, this is what I'm offering, this is my product, and people can invest as little as £10 to get like a small portion of shares in that company. their biggest successes like Monzo and Revolut have both been on there and raised money from their audience. So I spent a year working there. Their stack was predominantly PHP, which is not something I ever fell in love with, but I made it work. I found the developer experience of PHP particularly challenging, but I think that's quite a unfair statement to make, because I think it completely depends, doesn't it, on how you set up PHP. And I think there's some work that needs to go into developer experience, but I've seen some people develop like newer Laravel apps, and like their speed to production is phenomenal. So take my view of PHP with a pinch of salt. I've not invested any time in it since then. After that, I went to work at Curve. Curve is a fintech based in London. The idea is that you get a single card and then you can add all your cards behind that card, which sounds kind of confusing. But the idea is you can set up smart rules and say, well, if I tap my card at this merchant, then charge this credit card. If I tap it there, then charge this one. As well as you don't have to worry about like FX fees and stuff like that. If you just go abroad, you can just carry on using your card and they do the conversion at the interbank rate rather than you having to worry about which card to use, etc. I've always been interested in fintech, so I loved working there. This was my first foray into Go as well. Like, they were a PHP monolith and they were carving it out into Go microservices. And so I spent 2 years doing that. And I had a really good opportunity there. It was when I joined Curve, there was about 50 people. When I left, there was about 200. The engineering team grew from, I think when I started, there was probably like 6 to 8 of us. And maybe there's 30 or 40 when I left. So I got to see the scales of growth and how all those things work. I kind of moved from an IC role to sort of, it was a tech lead role there, but at Curve, tech lead included some managerial responsibilities. So I got to kind of give that a little bit of a try too. And then as we entered the pandemic, I didn't really want to commute to the office anymore. I felt ready for a change. And the reason I didn't want to commute to the office was because of the pandemic. I felt ready for a change. And truthfully, I was probably getting close to burnout, I think in hindsight is probably the case. So I decided at that point to look around. And I was very fortunate to, it's almost like a perfect role at Cloudflare, honestly. It was like, it felt like the amalgamation of all the things I'd done so far. It was a role that was focused on like developer tooling at Cloudflare, which is something I've always been interested in. And most of my experience had been working in developer tooling. So I interviewed there. This was for an IC role. So I joined Cloudflare as a software engineer in their like developer tooling group. I spent a year doing that. And then I got promoted to be the tech lead of that team. I spent a year being the tech lead for that team. And then I became the engineering manager for that team, which I still run today. And this is year 4 at Cloudflare now. So yeah, I've been doing it quite a bit.
Cool. There's a lot of things in there I'd like to pick apart, but I think I'm going to start with the end and work backwards.
Yeah.
So what is developer tooling? And an awful lot of people won't know. An awful lot of people, software engineering is building websites. There is nothing else. And that's, yeah, it's software engineers building websites is a big part of it, but it's still a small part of it, if you see what I mean.
So I first kind of personally experienced the value of developer tooling when I worked at GE. Like, GE had tens of thousands of software engineers all over the planet. Cloudflare is not quite that big yet, but we're definitely trending that way. And the way I like to think of it is we want our engineers to be as productive as possible by just giving them access to tools and best practices, which means they can just focus on shipping products. And I see everything our team does around enabling that. So some examples I'll give you is Cloudflare runs probably thousands of microservices and packages and various things deployed all over the place. New ones get created every week. These new services get created every week. Ideally, when I create a new service, I should get the best of everything. I should get the latest version of Go. I should get all the latest packages. I should get the latest structure of a project we've decided on. I should get the latest version of our CI pipeline. And ideally, I don't have to spend any brain cycles thinking about this. Like, I just push a button and all these things get kind of sorted for me. And then my job is to put in the business logic in the middle. That's the best way I can describe developer tooling. Is I like to imagine it's just a comment that's like, insert your code here. And if everything else happens around the outside correctly and our team does its job well, that's effectively all you need to do. And we'll do everything we can to make that as easy as possible for you.
So where do you draw the line with that between developer tooling and platform engineering?
I don't know, this is a bit of a cop-out of an answer, but I'm not really interested in drawing the line. So that my team, developer tooling, is in the platform group. Inside our group is also the Kubernetes team, as well as a team that we call Developer Insights, which kind of is metrics and data around developers, like how engineers are doing, like in terms of shipping code and stuff like that. So all those three things together work really, really well together to form a platform, right? So you've got Kubernetes, which is like the abstraction over the servers and stuff like that. And then you've got our tooling that goes over the top of that again. So I think the purest view of platform engineering is it's probably more like the Kubernetes team, but I certainly think of us as part of that platform group. And when we weave everything together, we give engineers a platform that they can build on top of. And, you know, to say what I said again, like just insert your code here and everything else will happen around it.
I've just left a role where I didn't get direct exposure to it myself, but there were a lot of complaints from the developers and the teams there that their platform engineering team were building a platform, which sounded great, but it was very, very narrow focused. It was, thou shalt do it this way. And unfortunately, that way didn't fit with any of the way that the existing teams were already building. How do you avoid that problem? How has your group or your organization been avoiding building something that doesn't fit the teams while presumably giving some sort of standardized level?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And you think there'd be an easy answer, but I don't think there is, unfortunately. So the way I think about it is our team's job is to make sure we spend a ton of time talking to other engineers and figuring out how they're doing things, like where their pain points are, and ensuring we're working on the highest value thing to solve it for them. I think there's two ways to look at platform engineering, but I see us as a service function. Like the engineers are our customers and like we need to help them to deliver products faster. It's not our job to tell them, like you must do things this way now because we wanted to deploy this thing. There are times when that happens, to be clear, especially for compliance reasons. There might be ways like you can't do that anymore. You have to do it this way, unfortunately. And even then, there'll be some flex to be say, well, we thought this was a good way to do it, but what you're saying is interesting and we can probably adapt it slightly to fit that workflow. So I think the key bit is just having lots and lots of conversations and, you know, being open to changing your view and the way of working. I think the other really challenging thing, though, is having like what some people call like the golden path. Like this is the way we recommend building. And if you follow this, you'll get great tooling and great support. If you want to kind of go off the golden path or the paved road, some people call it, then, you know, some of our tooling might not work for you and you kind of almost, maybe you're a trailblazer. Maybe you'll find something better. And if you do, please report back and we'll see if we can include it. But we'd really rather you only went off this path if there's something we're not supporting today and like there's a very good reason to do so. Balancing those two things is really, really hard because you want to encourage innovation, especially in a company like Cloudflare where we've got like hundreds of incredibly smart people. And so you don't want to stifle them and tell them they can't do things one way. But at the same time, the more they follow that paved road, the more automation we can do, the more of these cross-cutting concerns we can solve for them. And truthfully, I don't think I've got the golden bullet yet. I'm still looking for it. But I think just having lots and lots of conversations, publishing lots of blog posts and RFCs about this is what we're thinking, like tell me where I've got it wrong, is the way I've found is the best way to think about this stuff.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's the RFCs, it's having those conversations. And that's what wasn't happening in this organization. They were more coming along and we built a thing, you have to use it. It's like, but did you talk to anyone beforehand? And no, this is just the way you should be doing it. Yeah, I mean, having those conversations, yeah. As you say, you get hundreds or thousands of engineers all doing different things. There's never going to be that perfect solution that fits everyone. And we're not going to agree on it. But having the conversations, at least involving people, having the RFCs, that's got to be the way forward. And that's got to be what matters. So I'm going to go look back a little bit further now. I'm with you. I never fell in love with PHP, but I came to PHP from having worked building websites in C and then Perl. At that point, it seemed like a massive step forward and was a great thing to really improve the developer experience. Have you ever gone back as far as kind of lightning old-fashioned CGI scripts in C or Perl?
No, I wrote a lot of Java, which I know is not even comparable, but I did. I spent a ton of time writing Java at GE. And also at Cloudflare, we do have a surprising amount of Lua. So I wrote a little bit of Lua here and there as well. But no, I've never wrote CGI or Perl.
Okay, cool. Then I'm going to go back as well to the sandwich course. Again, it's a very valuable thing. I know a few people who've done them. Wasn't something that I did, but I wonder if your experience was similar to what I had. Now, while I didn't do a sandwich year, I worked every holiday throughout university. and should we say a proper job. You know, I was part of the team working on some things. The first summer I worked at one of the UK's first ISPs, and then throughout the time I worked with a traditional engineering company, a bit the way I think of GE as being, but on a smaller scale. And that changed how I looked at my university course, because my university was teaching us Pascal at the time. They were teaching us a lot of very abstract computational theoretical stuff. I mean, much more abstract than data structures and algorithms, like very theory of computation and things that, when I looked, there was only one textbook, for example, in the whole world. It wasn't a deeply studied subject. Whereas when I was doing the work, I was learning C, I was learning Perl, I was learning about CGI and web scripts, I was using Internet Explorer 1 and, you know, actually building real software in the real world. And that changed how I looked at my course, and I was starting to think, well, this isn't relevant to the job I'm going to do. I'm going to learn these skills instead. Did you get the same experience from Sandwich Course? Did it change how you looked at it and what you valued?
It did, but I've gone back and forth on this a little bit over the years. So, I mean, I want to be, I guess, categorical about this, but I do not see degrees as the be-all and end-all to get a job in software engineering. I think a lot of people struggle, and I understand why, because I think some job descriptions even say you must have a degree to apply. I know it's bad advice, but I would recommend ignoring it. I think for some companies, they might filter you out if you don't have one, but most, I mean, I've worked places where we've had that on the job spec, but I'd be more than happy to speak to people who have a great portfolio. So I think that's the first thing I wanted to call out, I guess. But the thing I think about degrees at the time, I was very frustrated that we weren't learning the things that were valuable. I was like, you know, why am I only learning how to data structures and algorithms? We had a module called Language and Logic, which was learning how sentences are formed, which makes sense now because I'm like, okay, so we were basically learning how parsers think. But at the time, it's just like, why are we doing this? This is mad. And we spent a whole bunch of time doing maths, which I've done a little bit of math throughout my career, but it's definitely not proportional to how much time we spent on it at university. So at the time, I definitely felt frustrated. And I felt I came out of university and I was like, I learned more in that year than I did in my degree for getting a job. But I think in hindsight, I think universities don't necessarily need to be there for you to, like, I think a lot of people think of them as a pathway to getting a job. And I think we've kind of made them that. But also, that's not really what universities were meant to be, right? They were meant to be there for folks who wanted to be academics and they wanted to study and further the field and they wanted to learn about it from an academic standpoint. And if you think about it through that lens, like what you learn in a computer science degree makes a bunch of sense. But if you think about it as this is just something I need to do to get myself a job, then yeah, I agree. It doesn't really necessarily set you up well. So I sometimes do wonder if we need like another paradigm. Like, is there something else folks, you know, like in the UK, we have apprenticeships. I always wonder if they're something that we should encourage more folks to do, because I think they have the potential to be really, really valuable if set up well. Yeah, and I do spend some time thinking about this. Like, should we be discouraging people to go to university and encouraging more folks to do apprenticeships or even just some of the, I know there's a lot of controversy around some of them, but I think the concept of like the coding boot camps is a good one, as long as they're structured and set up well. But yeah, I'm not really sure. Like, what do you think?
Yeah, I found my degree too theoretical, too far from the actual work I was doing. So I was a bit disappointed then. And at the time I reflected, I would probably have been better off doing a different degree, pursuing some of my other interests. And as you say, university is not really about giving you the skills to do the job. It's about giving you that academic thought process and that learning how to learn really properly on your own. So in some ways, I regret not doing a different subject. And that's possibly why I went back and did an MBA, because I wanted to learn some of those skills in a different way. I do see that computer science degrees from graduates I've talked about in the last 10 years have become a bit more vocational. They have more of a focus on, and it's not, as some people say, they should teach you how to use Git or they should teach you Go or something. They shouldn't be teaching that. That's the skills you can learn for yourself when you learn a job. They should be giving you the theoretical structure. They should be teaching about software engineering. And I think they've got a bit closer to that. So still grounded in the academic side, but should we say more relevant to the current day. Although I'm flip side, my son is currently studying for A-level computer science. And I still see some things in there I haven't seen anyone do for 30 plus years. So again, there's still that catching up and being, you know, we're still a relatively young field. So it'd be nice if they're a bit more relevant to stuff that's still current, without necessarily trying to be that hands-on apprenticeship. And I think if we look at this idea that software engineering is more of a craft and we have that software craftsmanship movement, apprenticeships would fit a lot better.
Can I ask you, you mentioned then that you did an MBA. Can I ask your opinion on those? It's something I've thought about over the years, like back and forth as to should I do one, should I not? Like, what's your view? Was it time well spent? A lot of people say it's the network you build that's the most valuable piece of it. So I'd love your thoughts on that.
So I think if you do it in person and you want to pursue and that more moving into kind of executive leadership, it probably is about the network. I did my distance learning. I was currently learning a business at the time. I just had my first child. I was fitting it around my life at the time. I found it incredibly useful because it really built up some of the skills around critical thinking, challenging things. I was like a kid in a candy shop when I got access to Athens and all the academic libraries. I managed to draw my distance learning MBA out over 5 years and retain access to Athens. And that's free access to a massive amount of scientific papers on every subject you want. And I made use of that for those 5 years. I found it fascinating. Again, I've been running a business for several years, so I found it quite interesting to dig a bit more into that. And I learned a lot about marketing. I learned a lot about corporate finance. Bizarrely enough, I found that I particularly enjoyed the finance modules. Having ribbed my brother for years for becoming an accountant, or not becoming, but training as an accountant, having knocked that and said how boring accountancy and finance was, I really enjoyed the finance side. And I ended up doing a specialism in finance and my dissertation in finance. So I found it incredibly useful, but not necessarily for the network, not for that I'm going to go and be a business consultant, but to put some bigger context and to understand what the rest of the business done and why we care, and to start thinking a bit more things about, you know, why do we care about currencies? Why do we hedge? Why does marketing care about this? What are the thoughts about it? And just have that bigger picture. And I think that's been incredibly useful for the rest of my career, for learning my own businesses, and for coming into startups and being able to add value as more than just, hey, I can build software and I can lead a team, but I get it. I know why to, you know, have that bigger concept. So yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I found it very useful.
Do you think it opened more doors for you?
It's definitely helped with two of the jobs that I've got. And you know, got me interviews and opened a few doors there. Most of the time, it doesn't make that much difference. And sometimes probably as well, there are a lot of software engineers that look down on an MBA. We think of people with MBAs as being counters and business consultants that don't get it. So I think it's probably an equal number of times when it's maybe been detrimental.
Interesting.
But I would do it again. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I learned a lot from it. And like I say, I think more software engineers need to have that big picture view of, we're working in a business or an organization that has bigger goals. The goal isn't to write software, fun as that is. The goal is to create some value for people. And there are many ways of doing that. And again, it gives you that bigger concept of, yeah, we all hate estimates in software engineering. But it gives you that understanding of why we need to think about them, because somebody's got to fund this project. And they've got to fund it from debt or equity or retained cash flow. So you start thinking a bit bigger picture and saying, well, yeah, estimates suck, but there's a reason we've got to do that. So like, instead of moaning about them or saying they suck or trying to pretend that we don't need estimates, start thinking about how to make them more useful and how to start presenting them as you would with a financial model of, you know, here's the worst case, here's the best case, these are the risks, this is what we can do to mitigate the risks, this is the challenges we face, and these are the checkpoints, and this is how we can move it forward, and this is where we can cut our investment or double down on it. So yeah, I think it's been incredibly useful for that. And I think more of us as software engineers would benefit from gaining some of that knowledge.
That's good insight. Thank you.
You're welcome. Going back to GE, did that exposure to those different business units and the different types give you some kind of similar insights? Did it give you a different view that, should we say, someone that's gone straight into a startup or straight into a big tech would have?
I like to think so. I think one of the biggest benefits of working at GE that I think is I didn't appreciate until a bit later in my career is working for a big corporate is things move a little slower and there's a lot more focus on coordination and planning and stuff like that. And I got exposed to some really great business leaders who were great at pitching and selling and communicating and planning. And I thought all that stuff was kind of boring at the time. And it has been probably the most useful skill I picked up from my time there. I think being a great communicator and planner and organizer is one of the most underrated skills software engineers should invest to figure out how to be better at. Like, if you need to learn one thing, like, that's the thing to go and learn, I think, is how to be better at organizing and planning and communicating. So that was a really amazing thing I took away from there that I didn't appreciate until years later. But like, in terms of the kind of software and the code we were working on, it was really nice to see completely different applications to software that I never really thought about, right? So like in aviation, we used to pull metrics off jet engines and figure out if they needed maintenance or not, if there was any faults or stuff like that. Like that's really cool and really interesting and impactful work. Something I never really thought about. Now, every time I sit on an engine, on a plane, I sit there staring out the window at the engine, like, I wonder what it's saying. And obviously working at GE Capital Bank was interesting in a different way. Like I got to learn a little bit about finance and thinking about how other companies fund initiatives, to your point that you just talked about there. Like that's basically what the company did, right? We lent money to small to medium businesses to help them grow. To be able to do that, you've got to know what growth looks like and what you're going to achieve and what you're going to do with the money. Like banks and lenders are going to ask you those questions. Also with financial software, you really don't want there to be any mistakes. So testing is very, very important. You don't want to calculate something wrong. You don't want to give someone the best deal they've ever had. And you also don't want to give them the worst deal they've ever had. Like if you make a mistake in software like that, you can literally close businesses, you know? So it's really important that you've got to get these things right. So I guess the importance of being defensive in programming was taught to me there. And I think people who worked with me will tell you that I'm really annoying about this. Like I write very, very defensive code, arguably too much so. And I think that comes from there. It's like everything had to be covered. Like we, you know, people get funny about aiming for test coverage, but we aim for 100% test coverage because we wanted to cover everything we could think of. We didn't always get there, but I think if you aim for the, was it, if you aim for the moon, you might land in the stars. So if you aim for 100, you might get 80, 90%, which is fine. So I became a bit of a stickler for that stuff from there. And then obviously I went to then go and work in startups where things were a little bit more scrappy. Like I think corner cutting sounds like it's got negative connotations, but I don't think it does. I think it's more about like, where is there opportunities to optimize for speed to market here, which was very different to the experience I had at GE, where it's like, okay, we need to delay 6 months. Like let's delay 6 months. It's more important that this is perfect than it is that we get out fast. Whereas if you go to startups, like you are racing to get things out before competitors, before money runs out, various other reasons. And so I really did enjoy getting insight from both. I truly believe that everybody would benefit from working in both places, even if for a short period of time. I think doing a stint in a big company and a startup, you'll learn a whole bunch and it will have a really good impact on your career.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I kind of did the same in reverse. So my first job was with one of the early UK ISPs. That was very much a startup. In fact, we went bankrupt a couple of weeks after I joined, but then got acquired out of bankruptcy. And then I went to that more traditional engineering company for the rest of my university holidays and for the first couple of years of my career. And you say it was a very different experience. I mean, we had built safety critical software for railways. And safety critical software were then a complete contrast to what I'd seen at ISP. And then after that company, I left and started my own business. And again, I went back to, I need to ship something quick. And suddenly, I need to learn how to sell. If we don't sell, I'm not eating this month, which again forces you to learn new skills really quickly. So I'm conscious of the time. I've been a really interesting chat, and I didn't want to leave without talking about Go and your involvement in Go and how you've taken that and how you have a very strong interest in debugging. So should we talk about Go or debugging first?
Let's talk about Go first, I guess. I guess one leads into the other a little bit, doesn't it? I kind of accidentally got more involved in Go, I think. I had the opportunity to write a book, which was the Domain-Driven Design with Golang. Which I think at the time I started working on that, beyond working at Cloudflare, I don't think I had any sort of real involvement or following in the Go community at all. But I wrote that book, and then I started to get people emailing me about it. And then people would ask me to go on podcasts to talk about it. And all of a sudden, I got the opportunity to be a little bit more involved. And I kind of just went with it. And to this day, I continue to just go with it. So I started a Twitter community, which is, I think, is the biggest on Twitter for Go. It's called Golang Insiders, with a focus on being friendly. I think the only other real big alternative is the Go Slack, which I think is pretty friendly. And then there's the Reddit Go community, which I haven't had the friendliest experience there, I don't think. So I wanted to build something that was okay for beginners to ask questions like, oh, I don't know why this doesn't work. Or a question that we had this morning was, I've deployed my app onto DigitalOcean and it's costing me money and I can't figure out why. Like, I want people to have a space where they can ask those questions because it's how we all learn. So I really wanted to build that. I've been speaking at conferences and stuff, which I've been really enjoying. I spoke at GovCon Singapore last year, which was a really great opportunity. So I'll be looking for more opportunities to speak at conferences. So I get to, you know, to the discussion we had before about working remotely, but then getting opportunities to meet people in person who care about the things you care about. Like, conferences are great for that. And then this year's sort of project, I guess, for me is I set a website called Bite Size Go. The goal of this is I want to build content that is for the beginner plus Go engineer. I think there's tons of stuff for beginners. Like, there's tons of stuff out there for people who, like, you know, write your first Go program or something like that. There's very little for the intermediate and an advanced Go engineer to kind of improve their skills too, beyond a few concurrency courses. Bite-sized Go, I want to do a mixture of like free and paid content, which will help people kind of level up from like the beginner to into the intermediate to hopefully into advanced topics eventually. So I started that, and the first thing I decided to cover was debugging. This came from I think some of the stuff I just described probably explains why I'm a little bit like this, but, you know, I've worked on safety critical systems, like having good test coverage and having not no errors, but because that's just impossible, but, like, you know, really thinking about how your system runs has been really important. And I do a lot of mentorship with folks in the Go community, usually folks who are looking for the first role, to try and help them get prepared and ready. One theme that came up often is they didn't know how to debug beyond log lines, like just putting print statements all over the place, removing them when they're done with them, and stuff like that. So, and also having worked at companies like Cloudflare, I've had a unique insight into how to debug in production at scale, right? And I wanted to share that experience because I think when I think back to how I learned all this stuff, I learned it all on the job. It kind of goes back to the university thing, right? Like, I didn't get taught any of this stuff explicitly. I kind of learned it over the last 10 years of working. Someone sat down with me, pair programming, and showed me how to use a debugger, and I've probably used it almost daily since. And, you know, I joined Cloudflare, and they were using Prometheus and Grafana, and they had logging strategies, and you had ways to measure test coverage and linting rules, and just all these things that help you write better, more performant software. Like, we have distributed tracing, we have profiling in place. None of this stuff has been taught explicitly, so I wanted to have a go at trying to explicitly teach it. So that's what took me down there. Debugging isn't like my thing, I guess. It's not like I'm like super passionate necessarily about debugging. I just think that everybody should know how to do it. I think it's really important, and I didn't see the content out there, so I wanted to kind of put it out there and hope that it could be helpful to others too.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's incredibly useful, and I was surprised in some of the blog posts you put out that people come back and say that they don't use a debugger, they don't know how, and even more so that some people are proud not to use a debugger and passionate about not using a debugger.
Yeah,
I found that strange. It's a tool. Might not always be the best tool, but why you discard any tool from your tool set?
My view is that even if you don't want to use it, like, you should know how to use it, and then you can have an opinion on whether you don't want to or not, and that's fine. But as long as you know how to use it and you want to discount it, that's totally okay with me. The biggest thing I found in all of this discussion, which I think was disappointing, is people were making value judgments. Like, oh, you're not a proper engineer if you use a debugger, or like, you only have to use a debugger if you can't like figure out how your system works, which is a red flag in itself. And I hate rhetoric like that. As you say, it's a tool. It was built for a reason. Some incredibly smart people use a debugger. The most famous being John Carmack did a podcast with Lex Fridman. John Carmack might be regarded as one of the most talented programmers of all time. So if he finds a debugger useful, I don't feel so bad about using it.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, my view has always been that you should know all of your tools. Because there'll be one time, even if you don't like using one, there'll be that one time when it'll get you out of a hole. You know, whether that's a debugger, whether it's logging, whether it's a profiler or whatever else, there'll be that one time where it's really useful and it's the right thing. And if you know it, you can use it. If you don't, you're still stuck in that hole and you haven't got a way of getting out.
Exactly.
I wanted to just go back. You mentioned talking in Singapore. That was probably the uniquest talk about Go that I've seen, and the ones I've been trawling through on various videos on YouTube. Can we briefly discuss that?
That talk is really funny, actually. I gave it to Singapore, and I wrote it up as a blog post as well, which is on the Bite-Size Go blog. I shared it on Hacker News, and it got like no interest. And then a few hours later, someone else shared it who I don't know, and it went viral. It went to the top of Hacker News. And then someone found my original post and wrote, "This is a duplicate." And that made me laugh a lot. Just Hacker News in a nutshell, I think. But yeah, for context, I'm a type 1 diabetic. This is a relatively new thing for me. Typically, folks get diagnosed as a child, but I didn't get diagnosed until I was 30 years old. Type 1 diabetes is a genetic condition. Most folks have probably haven't heard of it. I hadn't heard of it. But it's not caused by diet. It's not caused by lifestyle. It effectively means my body sees my pancreas as something to fight it. So I've got antibodies that kill insulin effectively, which means that I don't produce any. I have to artificially inject insulin to stay alive. It's pretty complicated to figure out how much that is. Everyone produces insulin throughout their day to keep them kind of their blood sugar steady. But every time you eat, it spikes, and your body produces insulin to account for the fact that you stay in some glucose. So my body doesn't do that. So I've got to inject insulin 6 to 10 times a day, depending on what I'm eating, what I'm doing. And it's challenging. So until very recently, this would meant pricking your finger every few hours to see what your blood sugar was and then taking a compensating action, whether that was taking insulin or sometimes eating. It's worth mentioning, if you have too much insulin in your system, you can kind of pass out and faint. It can be fatal, but having too much over a long period is bad for your health too. It can lead to going blind and stuff like that. So it's very much like a walking a tightrope. You just got to keep it as balanced as possible. But in recent years, thankfully, there's been some great advances, and I get to wear this. I don't know if you're able to see it on the camera, but I have like this patch on my arm, which monitors my blood sugar at regular intervals. The problem with that is the software is kind of limited. It's very sort of naive in the way it works. You have to tap your phone on it, and it doesn't have any sort of ability to escalate a lot. So like, say my blood sugar is really low. The app, I think there is some functionality to notify someone else, but I found it to be a bit patchy and a bit flaky. And so this is where I was like, well, there's a problem here. It's kind of important that I fix it. So I'm going to figure out how to fix it. So I basically did. I bought some of the hardware. I put it over the top of the sensor. I emit some metrics. I picked those up, and I wrote a bunch of Go code to do a bunch of stuff depending on what my blood sugar is. So if it's too low, it triggers an incident, which I leverage some of my experience from Cloudflare to figure out how to do that. And if it's too high, it sends me sort of push notifications as well as to friends and family if I want to, just to let them know that I might need some support because things aren't going so well. The really great thing about this project, and I think the biggest takeaway from it, is it really helped me learn about my condition, right? I think when you try and put something into code, like computers only do what you tell them to do. So if you're going to try and codify something, you've got to really understand it. And for me personally, for a condition that I'm going to have for the rest of my life, that was a really valuable way to spend sort of 3 to 6 months, just like learning how it worked, like what the formulas were for various things and figuring it out. I use the debugger a lot. I wrote lots of tests. It's important I got this right. I'm not necessarily advocating that everybody should try and become their own doctors and manage their own health this way. But for me, it was a really great exercise. I've been asked a few times to open source the code, and I'll never do that. Like, if it fails for me, I'm okay with it. I'm not being responsible for it not working for someone else. I'm not that confident in it yet. Maybe one day we can talk. But I think it goes back to our previous conversation about, you know, seeing how code's used at GE and at banks. And I think people forget that you really can do anything with software. Being a software engineer is genuinely a superpower, in my opinion. And it's, you know, there's a lot of focus on getting jobs and stuff like that is the goal for a lot of people. But also take a look around you and see what sort of optimizations and improvements you can make to your own life with this new power that you have. Because for me, it's been a game changer.
Yeah, and it's a great way to learn, as you say, about both yourself and your own situation and how to build software, and that you're building something real, which is something I'm a big advocate of.
One thing I just wanted to add is I haven't had it all my life. It can develop. Like you can sort of develop it throughout your life. So I didn't have it until I was 30. It's one of those conditions, once you discover it, like, it's kind of, you need to sort it quickly or you'll die. It really is that simple. So most people discover it by going into a coma. So I guess it's a good opportunity to call out that if you're feeling overly thirsty, if you're going to the bathroom a lot, if you feel a bit lightheaded, if you have a wound that's not healing particularly quickly, you should probably get down to the doctors and get checked, because they are all the symptoms that led to me sort of getting checked out and discovering if I have high blood sugar. It can also be similar symptoms for type 2. So if you experience any of those symptoms and they seem a bit irregular, like, speak to a doctor, because you may have nothing. It might just be summer and you're a bit more thirsty than usual, but it's definitely worth getting checked.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. I think that's important. And I hope anyone that is feeling that follows your advice and does get it checked out. Talked a little bit remote working, and I know that you've been looking at, I think you're doing a talk to Lead Dev later this year on managing across time zones and running a remote team. Tell us about that. What are you talking about? What are your views on how you manage across time zones and make a remote team work?
Yeah, so that's exactly what my talk is going to be called. As you said, it's managing across time zones, retrospective. And I think that the last phrase is really important, is the most important thing I've learned about managing across time zones is to have lots of touch points where you go, like, how are we doing? Like, is this working? What can we change? And letting the team guide the way they want to work. Because there's not going to be a bunch of time where you can have, like, in-person meetings. So they're really, really valuable. Making yourself get to an asynchronous model is important. So it's important just to check in, like, how's our process going? How's our on-call process working? How's our sort of meeting cadence working? Like, what should we change? What should we delete? What should we experiment with? 2 weeks later, discuss it again. Did that make things better? Did it make it worse? Like, what should we try next? So just building like a culture of experimentation around not just code, but culture. And then the other most important thing is to, for me specifically, is to set guardrails. Like, this is the things we need to achieve. Like, this is the sort of things we need to work on. But then after that, like, empower the engineers to make their own decisions and to back them, back those decisions too. I always say we hire really smart people, like, they should tell us what to do. And I really believe that. So when, because especially I have folks in SF and I'm in London myself, like, I don't want them to have to wait a whole 24 hours for me to make a decision to figure out what they should do next. I'd rather they should make the decision. And we can maybe we can discuss it afterwards if it was particularly something that I feel strongly we should go the other way. But most of the time, I'll just back them and be like, okay, that seems a good decision. Let's go and let's see if it happens. So being very sort of deliberate with, this is our objective. This is what we're trying to achieve. Let me know what support I can give you is sort of the way to do that.
So I'm a big believer in retrospectives myself. And it sounds like you're taking very much servant leadership approach. Where can people find you? How can people get in touch? Where should they go to learn more about the debugging course and Byte Size Go?
Yeah, so for the debugging course specifically and Byte Size Go, you can check it out on bytesizego.com, where byte spelled B-Y-T-E. It's supposed to be a pun on the Go slice, Byte Slice. And for the most part, I'm over on Twitter. So my username is Matt James Boyle with 2 T's. And that's the best place to find me. I'm a forever online, and you'll find me there most of the time. I also, I don't know if you've got this yet, John, I downloaded AirChat last night. Have you seen this?
I haven't tried it yet.
So you can find me over there too. I'm Matt Boyle on there too. I'm going to be playing around with there for the next couple of weeks.